Hello, 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 everyone, and welcome to Honey Badger Radio. My name is Brian, and this is The Week in Men's Rights. I'm here with Christoph Petgauz. I hope I said that right. You can unmute yourself now. Christoph, you do a lot of work in the field of, or in the area of Title IX specifically. You have been on the show before, but for people who don't know, you know, who you are and what you do, could you tell us a little bit about that?
I'm a PhD student at the University of Southern California, and I've started doing this after I realized how extensive discrimination against men is on college campuses. And the discrimination is really multi-pronged. We have financial discrimination. There are a lot of female on the scholarships, for example. Even though women are the majority on college campuses, there are concerns about discrimination against men in athletic scholarships, so I haven't really started looking into that. There are, of course, many, many concerns about discrimination against men in sexual harassment tribunals. Many cases have been slowly, you know, wading through federal courts on that specific field. There's been a lot of legal commentary on the topic as well. There's also medical discrimination, which is kind of like a recent field that I started looking into. There are sometimes, for example, women's heart centers or cancer centers for women with nothing equivalent for men.
Whoa.
That's another field that I started looking into.
So you say that this is on college campuses. There's medical discrimination against men, or is it more so like in favor of women?
Against men and in favor of women. That's simultaneous, and it's really synonymous. College campuses, of course, still have to fund hospitals, so there are educational facilities. Title IX is this federal law which prohibits discrimination in educational institutions, but it also applies to medical facilities that are tied to educational institutions, if that makes sense.
So you're saying that, like, if you're on a college campus and there's a hospital on the campus, then those hospitals discriminate against men and in favor of women.
Sometimes. Yeah, not all the time, but there's still substantial discrimination. And it's important to, you know, look into multiple parameters before you kind of arrive at, like, a final conclusion. But generally speaking, of course, there are certain departments which do not violate anti-discrimination status just because they cater to sex-specific interests. A urology department or a medical or, you know, like a gynecology department or a department that focuses on breast cancer does not necessarily violate Title IX per se, but there's still a lot of other things. When you have, for example, a health center that focuses exclusively on helping basically women who suffer from heart disease, then that is a violation of Title IX because heart disease is not exclusive to women. But still, some institutions like Cornell do it anyway because, you know, who cares about men?
Right. Yeah, I guess what we're seeing here is the Title IX is not being followed in the way that it's written. Essentially, it's only treating discrimination as an issue when it's against women, but not when it's against men. Right.
Yes, and there's a huge history behind that. There are unfortunately plaintiffs and radical feminist attorneys who file massive lawsuits against educational institutions, sometimes for, you know, sexual harassment disputes, sometimes for other things. Just the University of Southern California has very recently signed a $215 million settlement with the, you know, victims of George Tyndall, who's a gynecologist. There's another lawsuit against Dartmouth College for $70 million. And if you look at the circumstances, it's kind of shaky. I mean, you have this female students who somehow got into a male professor's hot tub, and then they decided retroactively that they were victims of sexual harassment, and they are now demanding $70 million. And even the gynecologist lawsuit is kind of odd because they're basically saying that they were victims of sexual harassment because the gynecologist does not use gloves during medical treatments. So if you're not using gloves during, you know, medical treatment of women when you're a male gynecologist, I don't know if that's a breach of ethical principles per se, but it strikes me as very odd that they would somehow arrive at this conclusion that every patient would then need $200,000. That's a massive settlement, and that's that's like a huge waste of taxpayer money and also tuition dollars. Like students are paying, students are going to pay for this. Students are going to pay for this settlement. So that really blows my mind, to be honest. And if he is, you know, a serial predator, as some people have maintained, then I think maybe like he should serve time in prison. But this way, then USC students have to shoulder that settlement by paying more and more tuition, not just, of course, like students, but also donors who donate to the institution, then that's really a burden on them. So the people who are being punished in this scenario are really the students who are paying tuition to the college, as well as donors who donate money to the institution, not to mention taxpayers at large. So it's really a broken, bizarre system that we are trying to fix. There has been a little bit of progress, but generally speaking, it's very slow. They are very entrenched in academia, as well as in mainstream press, so it's difficult.
Yes, and you have personally run into a great many obstacles to your actual well-being. So I want to, before we get into that story, though, there's some more stuff I want to learn about you.
Sure.
You have an accent.
Yes.
where are you originally from?
I grew up mostly in Turkey, although I attended schools where the language of education was English. So it's a hybrid accent that doesn't really exist anywhere else, I think. Mm-hmm. When I do speak Turkish, I also work as a translator. They can also understand that I have an accent. So it sucks that, you know, I speak both languages with an accent, I guess.
Yes. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And when you were, I guess, like when did you find out that this Title IX stuff was something that you wanted to give attention to?
I was reading Warren Farrell's The Myth of Male Power, actually, when I was flying to the U.S. for the first time. So I've always been interested in these issues. I was also involved in Title IX personally as well. I was accused of harassment by a woman who said he was manipulating my emotions and lying to me by telling me that he was not attracted to me. So I was literally accused of sexual harassment by a woman who said, well, he was manipulating my emotions and lying to me by telling me that he was not attracted to me. So basically, she directly accused me of sexual harassment because I spurned her emotions. Now, this is really, like, this may strike, I guess, like, some people as, like, really crazy, but it's actually stuff that happens on college campuses all the time. I mean, you have these women who are exposed to, you know, training materials, like sexual harassment training materials, that indoctrinate them into thinking they are perpetual victims. And complaints like this are very, very common, especially at USC. We've seen a lot of, like, really crazy situations.
Mm-hmm.
That was, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It happens all the time.
Yeah. So, okay. So we'll like get into what this GoFundMe is about. So you've been doing this for some years now, right?
Yeah.
Right? And you've also worked with NCFM.
Yes.
Is that right? That's the National Coalition for Men, for those of you who don't know. And they do a lot of great work. You see them prominently featured in The Red Pill, Harry Crouch, Mark Angelucci, among others. And so, but, you know, you have run into some problems at your university. And yeah. I thought that maybe you could tell us about it. And this is why we have a GoFundMe right now. Can you tell us what's going on with what happened to you and your university? What's your story?
It's really a series of actions. It's not just like a single isolated incident. But I think as things currently stand, I've been deprived of my stipend. So what happens is when a PhD student wants to extend his or her contract, those renewals are routinely granted. I know, for example, a different student who I believe extended her PhD until the ninth year, if I recall correctly, and she basically received like a stipend at each year. So those renewals are routinely granted. In my case, I basically had to extend my PhD for another year. It's usually uncommon for PhD students to finish their studies in just 5 years. That's the maximum time, but usually people take time writing their dissertation. So I wanted to extend my dissertation and I was told that the university is not going to do that. So they're basically not going to give me a stipend. They're also basically denying every other chance to work for the school. So I, for example, applied for several fellowships. They were, of course, like all denied based on different pretexts. I also applied to work as an assistant lecturer, which was also denied. I then applied to work as a TA for the professors in the English department, where, of course, like radical feminism is very influential. And that was also denied. So basically, they denied every option to deny me. They denied every option to offer me some kind of funding. And I guess like the difficulty is all of my advocacy has been pro bono. So unlike the radical feminist attorneys who file these like massive lawsuits against institutions, we have to work pro bono. There are some professional attorneys who defend accused male students, and of course they do get paid, but their work is like more similar to criminal law, whereas like what we are doing is more of like just like charitable, for charitable purposes. And in a certain sense, because the public's perception is so skewed when it comes to men's rights, you know, because of mainstream media and as well as some other, you know, social media censorship, we basically have to do this pro bono, because, you know, even if like you start asking payment for what you're doing, then people immediately start vilifying you because there are so many double standards. For example, one thing that I noticed was I filed several complaints. So the Department of Education accepted complaints against Yale, Princeton, and USC filed by me. And then some feminist journalists started saying, well, basically they started accusing me of being a mass filer because at that time there were three complaints open. Now, the problem with that is that during the Obama administration, there were actually several feminist activists who spammed the Department of Education with thousands of complaints. And of course, nobody was really objecting to that. So
of course, when you
have a male student who files like several complaints, then mm-hmm. he suddenly becomes a mass filer. So in a certain sense, even though what we are doing is basically philanthropic work, at the same time, I realized that my reputation was getting destroyed for what I was doing. So it's actually very, very difficult and unsustainable in my experience, like engaging in advocacy for men's rights. Well, first of all, it usually doesn't really generate any revenue. And second, it actually destroys your reputation. And third, it can also lead to the termination of your employment, which is, I guess, in a sense, what happened to me. So given all these factors, and you know, basically like feminists have fixed the system so that it's like this, so that, you know, men have no incentives to engage in advocacy to stand up for their own rights. So it's not a bug, it's a feature. And there are still like a small number of people who are pushing forward, like who are still like pressing forward with these complaints despite the odds. But generally speaking, it's a very difficult and it's a very challenging line of advocacy. And it's also very difficult to sustain, as I noticed.
Yeah, absolutely. It's doing men's activism is definitely has to come from a place of passion, because there isn't, it comes with tremendous risk. Yeah. And it also, you know, yeah, it's not very profitable. I mean, if I wanted to make money, I'd just say I'm a feminist and start making YouTube videos.
Exactly,
and stuff.
Yes.
I can get on the TED Talks and talk about, you know, queer kid stuff, but which actually happened.
You actually don't have to do anything. You can just apply for really ridiculous scholarships on colleges.
Oh, really?
Women's studies and women's centers distribute all these like stupid scholarships to radical feminists. I know intersectional feminists on USC's college campus who write really bad poetry. You know, there's like 10 to 15 lines of really bad postmodern poetry, and they get paid massive stipends. They receive like massive fellowships because, you know, as long as you just repeat the party line, as long as you do what feminists want, then usually it's very easy to receive.
Wow.
A stipend or a fellowship on college campuses. Unfortunately, that's the case.
Yeah, I'd love to see how much they get for that. That's something that I'm really curious about now that you mention it. So
the Cornell complaint, which, mm-hmm. as you may recall, it was a coalition complaint. It was signed by a lot of people, 192 signatures. There were a lot of prominent signatories, including Jordan Peterson, Christina Hoff Sommers, etc., law professors, think tank presidents. So there was a lot of advocacy work done for that complaint. And one program in the Cornell complaint, and I believe there was a total of 30 programs that we were challenging. So one program had an endowment of almost $300 million. So that's the funding. This is like a feminist organization. It's like an all-female organization. I can kind of like check the document that has like an endowment of $300 million. And that's really crazy. So, and they distribute all this money to, you know, like female college students, even though they're the majority in colleges, and even though women are also the majority of academic employees. So women are both the majority of students, undergraduate students, graduate students, and academic employees. But despite this fact, there are still a lot of endowments, scholarship programs, women's centers, women's studies that distribute massive amounts of money to women only here in the United States. So that's the current, status of the academic scam industry as it is run by feminists.
Wow. So yeah. did you, how old were you when you left Turkey?
That was 5 years ago. So I was 25.
Do you guys have the same, do you think anyway, that you have the same kind of feminist culture in, you know, over there that we do here?
No, not necessarily. Actually, I was very supportive of feminism while I lived in Turkey. My involvement in Turkish politics is really complicated, but I was a sympathizer in Turkey's main opposition party, and I guess that party positions itself on the left-wing end of the spectrum. I think it's a member of the European Parliament of Social Democrats, European Party of Social Democrats. But at the same time, politics in Turkey is very different from politics in the United States. I think in Turkish politics, the main objective of the opposition party is to oppose Islamic fundamentalism. That's really the main banner, I think. And, you know, other issues like feminism or like identity politics, that's not really anywhere as important. Whereas here in the United States, like soon after I came here, you know, I was labeled as a white male. Like an angry white male on college campuses, which is kind of interesting, even though I'm an immigrant. When I first went public with the Yale complaint, I received a lot of hate that specifically attacked me for being a white male, which was, again, interesting. And I think it's because when you're challenging affirmative action in colleges, and affirmative action, you know, does harm white men to a great degree, I think all men are negatively affected in general. I think that's why kind of like I received all those attacks. I still have all the messages. It's interesting, all those like negative articles, like death threats on Twitter, like things like that. So I guess like the context of American politics is different. Also, leftists in the United States actually do support some Islamic organizations, like the Southern Poverty Law Center, for example, is very supportive of the Islamic Brotherhood. So yeah, anyone who criticizes,
It's the enemy of my enemy is my friend, I think, is the approach that a lot of the leftists in the States and also in the UK and Canada, they're the same. They side with Islam because Islamists specifically, because they oppose the same thing that the leftists oppose. So.
Yes, I understand that mentality, although I guess I'm the exact opposite. So I was a leftist in Turkey. Now I'm kind of siding with conservatives in the United States. So yes, there's kind of like a really weird, you know, Alice in Wonderland effect.
Yeah, so like in Turkey, you're saying in Turkey, the leftists actually oppose Islamists?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That's very intense. Those cultural struggles are very intense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Is there? I think so. Here in the West, at least in the States, one of the reasons why the left opposes, they side with Islam or Islamists, is that they actually have more of a disgust reaction to Christianity. So they despise Christianity more than they do Islam. And so they side with Islam, right, over Christianity.
I think it might also just be a general, Muslims are a minority in the West. So yeah, there's the whole concept so they, of minority rights. But
yeah.
But the thing is, it doesn't really stay with that. I mean, SPLC, for example, labels any critic of the Islamic Brotherhood as an extremist. It's right there on their website. So according to Southern Poverty Law Center, anybody who wants to classify the Islamic Brotherhood as a terrorist organization is himself a terrorist. And that's probably the strangest, like, it's so strange that I think I'm still trying to wrap my head around it, because Turkey's main opposition party actually does classify the Islamic Brotherhood as a terrorist organization.
Yeah.
And it's so obvious to me. I mean, and
I was guessing
Turkey's main secular opposition party has like tens of millions of voters. Like it's like a huge mainstream party.
I was just going to say that I think it might just be a matter of one is more of the establishment in Turkey, perhaps, whereas here they're more a minority. Is that fair, you think?
Yes and no, but I mean that's like a really bad line of reasoning, because the Islamists in the West do collaborate with the Islamists in countries where they are the majority. It's still the same political movement. So yeah, yeah. And classifying whether or not the Islamic Brotherhood is classified as a terrorist organization by the West, of course, has a huge impact on the rights of religious minorities and political dissidents in the greater Middle East.
Yeah.
So it does have a huge effect. I mean, we live on the same planet, so you can't just, you know.
Oh, no, for sure. For sure. I'm trying to work out the logic, I guess, of the. I guess, yeah. You know, the sort of leftist activists in the United States. Yeah. I don't think it's rational. I'm trying to work it out. But okay, so that was a bit of a side thing, but I was curious about it because I'm interested in, I guess, the ways in which the discussions around things outside of men's issues intersect with men's issues. So things like religious fundamentalism and general leftism and global politics, because I think that there is I think that men's issues are kind of like undergirding a lot, if not all, of these discussions, but they don't ever become about men because no one wants to talk about men. So they talk about other stuff that is definitely related to it, but they never talk about it directly. So I'm always asking these questions, something that I'm genuinely curious about. But okay, so like, can the University of Southern California just took your money away because of your political views?
Yeah.
And is there nothing you can do to fight against that? Or is that just, it's like they're a private company, they can do whatever they want? Or?
No, I mean, you can file a federal lawsuit, which is very, very expensive. So it can be done. But I mean, I would need a fundraiser, then, you know, give all that money to lawyers who may or may not be successful. And I did file a civil rights complaint with the Department of Education, you know, to see what happens. There's no guarantee of success with either method, because institutions do have quite a bit of deference, like legal deference in their own internal affairs, which is really sad. So when you have a small number of these identity politics zealots who take control of the institution, they can actually use all those legal protections to advance their political agenda. And that really sucks. And this is what's going on with a lot of educational institutions across the country. You have the small numbers of like really radical far left cliques. They usually tend to be very vocal. And they usually control some key positions, like these diversity bureaucrats, for example, who have the power to terminate anyone's employment if, you know, if he's saying the wrong things.
Yeah.
Or usually, like, journalism in general is a very partisan industry, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
So they control the exchange of information. And they also get to decide, you know, who is employed and who is unemployed. All these, like, human resources departments in major corporations are staffed by these identitarian types. So of course there's like resistance. Of course there are like a lot of people in academia, I think, who disagree with what these people are doing. But given the fact that they have monopolized all the important positions, they get to exert a disproportionate amount of influence.
Yeah.
And that sucks, but, you know, there's only so much that I can do. I've been fighting for years, so I've done a lot of things. There was one professor who was facing basically like a riot almost. Some protesters on our college campus, they were protesting him because he sent in an email to a lot of people. But he basically said accusers sometimes lie.
Yeah.
And that really annoyed, you know, the feminists on our college campus. So they basically gathered, they had this like protest to call for his like termination. And I was kind of his like an informal bodyguard, like during the protest, you know, in case something happens. Nothing happened. So, but I do, I try to help, I guess, like other people kind of as like a center of the resistance, so to speak, against like the college ideology. So, but at the same time, when you kind of like engage in all these activities, it leads to out of pocket expenses. It's also very time consuming, and it's also sometimes very thankless. So you don't always get positive results. So for every victory, you know, there's a failure like the road. So it's not easy.
No, not at all. And it sounds like it's probably just easier to do exactly what you're doing, which is just set up a GoFundMe and say, well, you know what, I'm going to try not to rely on the university, you know, for my survival, even though this is something I was supposed to get. And you're a PhD student too, right?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, is any of this stuff making it, making it harder for you to get your PhD? Is this like an obstacle?
Yeah, unfortunately. When I was about to defend my dissertation prospectus, which is, you know, like a summary of what you're going to defend in your dissertation down the road, there were basically five members of my dissertation committee, and one of them is a professor called Hilary Shore, and she's this radical feminist, you know, who always interferes with like other people, tries to silence them when they say something that is even remotely critical of her political views. So she's kind of like the local tyrant in the English department. Mm. And she's also the one who wrote the letter asking President Nikias to step down after the allegations about the gynecologist, you know, came to the surface. And I thought it was kind of like a really ridiculous request, because the president actually has nothing to do with those decisions. Like, those are handled by the Title IX office, by two individuals called Keegan Alley and Gretchen Davlinger Means. Keegan Alley is this like radical lesbian feminist, you know, who's almost like a card-carrying man-hater. I mean, it's impossible to...
She sounds like a cartoon character.
It's impossible to parody her. I mean, not all feminists are like that, obviously. Like, not all of them are like that extreme, but she is, you know, she's a parody of herself. She's like really that bad. And the other one is a prosecutor who's been doing this for a long time, and like some prosecutors, unfortunately, she seems to have developed a God complex. She doesn't like her decisions questioned. We did some background research on her when she was working as a prosecutor in San Diego. She perjured herself to send a man to prison for 35 years. I can upload that document online. Like, these are not state secrets or anything. The reason we know about this is because there was a female public defender who basically realized what is going on, and she intervened because she felt like the injustice was so great, and she filed a motion for reconsideration, and that was granted at that time, and the man was released from prison. But basically, I think like her testimony basically provides evidence that Gretchen perjured herself to send a potentially innocent man to prison for 35 years, and this woman is USC's Title IX coordinator. So these two individuals have basically handled the entire decision-making process throughout the years. Like, really, whatever happens is their fault, because the president actually does nothing, as far as I know, when it comes to these decisions. But still, you know, because the president is, because US's president was basically a white male, so they were looking for a scapegoat at that time. So they wrote this letter, which is like full of unscientific bullshit, like all these outdated statistics and everything. But it's part of their like outrage culture to, you know, instigate these witch hunts. Mm-hmm. So they asked for President Nikias to step down, and he did step down. I don't think he had an ethical obligation to do so, but he did step down graciously. The professor who wrote the letter asking for President Nikias to step down, her name is Hilary Shore, and she's the same professor who basically tried to sabotage my dissertation in secret. And I know this because a different professor accidentally forwarded an email to me, and I can send that email to you, in which Hilary Shore was basically like trying to veto my dissertation in secret, while all the other members of the dissertation committee, there was a total of 5 members, so all 4 voted yes, and Hilary Shore voted no. And at the same time, she wanted the project to fail immediately. So before I could even like replace her with a different professor so that I can continue, and she was doing this in secret. So that's, I think, collusion. If, you know, the word collusion or like conspiracy has any meaning, I think that applies to Hilary Shore's action. And there's like a history of mental health problems. I think that she has student reviews going back to 2008, which complained about her mental health problems. And I think they are true. Like she's kind of like an interesting professor. Like she writes these doodles in class.
What?
Her speech pattern is kind of really strange.
Is it Hilary Shore? Is that her name?
Yes.
I'm going to look her up while you're talking about her. S-H-O-R-E?
S-H-O-R.
S-H-A-O-R?
S-C-H-O-R.
S-C-H-O-R. Okay, hold on. I'm going to look her up while you're finishing the story about the doodles and stuff.
Yeah. So anyway, so basically, like, she told all the other professors that she wanted the dissertation to fail. And she wanted the dissertation to fail immediately before I could even, like, replace her with a different professor. So, like, how is that, like, good faith behavior? So it's obviously, it's obviously not an ethical thing to do. But anyway, I learned this because the email was accidentally forwarded to me. Then I replaced her with a different professor who is, you know, not like this. So I was able to defend my dissertation prospectus at that time. This was last year. Because I have no idea if I'll, you know, ever graduate from the institution, but it, I mean, at the same time, the college degrees are becoming so meaningless. I'm not even sure if I should even put an effort to graduate from the school. I don't really know what I can do with a PhD from English. Unfortunately, I used to love the English literature. That's why I kind of I wanted to finish my PhD. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's very little, especially if you have political views, which distinguish you from the rest of these like English majors or even humanities in general.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then chances of employment are practically zero anyway.
Yeah.
So
yeah. English teachers, in my experience, English professors, they all have, or at least the overwhelming majority of them have like a feminist slant in their it's in their curriculum. It's just in their bias, just baked in. And I hate making broad statements like, you know, like painting with a broad brush, but I think that if we accept the fact that the majority of people in academia or the majority of colleges have a left-leaning bias, a pro-feminist bias, then where most of that bias lives is going to be in the humanities, in like the literature and stuff like that. You're not going to find it in STEM. I mean, you are, but it's not going to have as much of an impact in STEM when people are just taking calculus. It's just they haven't figured out how to get feminism into that. But I have taken English classes in 3 different colleges, and all of them have had, you know, they've just straight up had Marxism. They just say, we're going to talk about Marxism now, you know, and I'm like, oh, I guess that's what we're talking about. So, yeah, and feminism and all that. And they make it all kind of one thing, too. It's not separate. So I looked up her USC Dornsife. I'm not sure what that is. USC Dornsife. Page for this Hilary Shore. She's professor of English and comparative literature. Just a little bit about her. Professor Shore studies contemporary fiction, feminist theory, and the widest possible range of Victorian literature from serial fiction, narrative poetry, art criticism, proto-sociology, and urban history. Nothing Victorian surprises her anymore. Her more unexpected research efforts focus on gender studies, film and popular culture, law and literature, and 20th century fiction. She is currently writing an on adaptation, Betrayal and People Who Fall Down in Films. She is the author of studies of the novelist Elizabeth Gaskell and Charles Dickens, as well as essays on characters.
Look, yes. What?
Yeah. And so on.
I don't know how to interpret that. But she was teaching introduction to literary theory to a bunch of students, and nobody liked her class. It's not just the ideological slant, but also like she's a bad professor anyway. So, I guess, you know, she's not the only one. I think she's the most radical. She's the most radical one in the English department. She's the one who is like an unhinged extremist. But of course, this political bias issue is not just limited to Hilary Shore. And there are many others, you know, who have a similar slant.
Sure.
And I think English, of course, is like a legitimate discipline that should always be English departments. So it's not the fact that like we shouldn't abolish English departments or anything like that. Unlike, let's say, women's studies, which in my opinion should be abolished. They're completely... first of all, they violate Title IX. Like, you can't really have women's studies with nothing equivalent for men, especially the way that they are designed, the way that they discourage male applicants from applying, the way that they dictate a specific ideology. So all of that really contributes to the overall environment. But I don't think, of course, like English departments should remain on college campuses. But it's just that given the current state of scholarship, or like grievance studies just taking over the curriculum at large, I think they've become increasingly obsolete, and they've made themselves irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my summary of my PhD. After 5 years of like really dealing with these people, that's my final comment, I guess, on the state of the English discipline.
I guess, and I know that you're running out of time. I don't know how your battery is doing.
Let me see. I have 17 minutes.
Okay. All right. Well, we can go for about 10 more, and then I'm going to wrap up and go to the after show anyway. But first of all, I just want to tell the people watching, if you guys have any questions or anything you want to add, please send us a super chat. But what's better is if you go to the GoFundMe and throw a couple of shekels into Christoph's hat there, because, he's lost all of his stipends because of the work he's trying to do in Title IX. And I think that if we can, let's try to give it back to him. So please go to the link. I put it in the low bar to go to this this GoFundMe page, and just throw a couple bucks in there. He does a lot of great work. And again, I have a section here that says he has a proud record for advocacy for the rights of religious minorities and dissidents who are persecuted by Islamic fundamentalism. We talked a little bit about that too, right? I assume that's something you still believe in. It's just sort of expanded into the general sort of men's issues as well. Is that right?
Men are a minority on college campuses in the United States, so I guess there's an analogy.
that's right.
I mean, if you're looking
being
for
persecuted
like a general
by religion,
framework of ethics,
yeah,
I think my general inclination is to sympathize with whichever group is being persecuted, you know, in whatever political environment that I find myself in. So in Turkey, that was mostly religious minorities. Like there are like some Islamic fundamentalist groups, as well as some extreme Turkish nationalists, especially if they have a religious flavor. Those groups tend to display a lot of like hate against religious minorities, like against Armenian and Jewish minorities, for example. I signed a 2016 declaration on in support of the Kurdish minority. So that's an ethnic minority, not a religious minority. There's mm-hmm. some overlap. But and the Turkish government is prosecuting the people who signed that human rights declaration. So I do have that background. And I think part of the reason I became a men's rights activist is because I really read what men's rights activists were saying. I read Warren Farrell's The Myth of Male Power, as well as several of his other books. And it's very persuasive. I mean, once you look at the underlying arguments, it's really true, I think, that men are the ones who are facing discrimination. I think perhaps even on a global scale, there are several studies that have been published fairly recently, which found that it's not just, you know, in the West, but even in many other countries. I think with the possible exception of some Muslim majority countries where I actually did support feminism, I think in most countries, men are the ones who are facing more disadvantage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because there's such a huge, for example, disparity that favors women in the criminal justice system, in family courts, I think especially in the education sector as well. So those three fields are where women have massive advantages. And I don't think that that's not right. So somebody has to do something about it. So in my case, I guess that happened to be me. And my advocacy has been very extensive. Like, I've been working very, very hard. So the complaints that I wrote are very time consuming. For the Cornell complaint alone, I had to reach out to like hundreds of people to collect signatures. But even writing the complaints are very time consuming, and it's like a very intensive process.
Yeah.
So that's why I could just kind of like decided to, I guess, like announce what I've been doing to the world. And I mean, run my GoFundMe campaign, among other things.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. And in your university, out of curiosity, and again, guys, go, you know, throw some money at the GoFundMe, because he's got to, you know, he's got to like keep living, right? So if we can, let's try to help him out.
Hopefully.
it's already raised like $2,600 in 8 days, but you know, he's got a long way to go. So if you can, give whatever, it doesn't matter how small, it all adds up. You know, if everyone just gave a couple bucks, he'd be well on his way. So this is a really like a real David and Goliath situation. And I know that phrase gets thrown around a lot and is kind of like overused by people. But because of that, it can be really daunting. I'm wondering, what is the campus community, like the student communities in your campus, the people that you go to class with, the people that you, you know, share a room with, whatever. Do you get any support from them? Is there sympathy for men's issues, or are you just like a outcast, like?
That's interesting. Like, there is, first of all, a significant, I think a majority on college campuses, they are not really that interested in politics. So mm-hmm. You have a certain non-political majority, and then you have a very politicized and a very vocal minority that is very dedicated to identity politics. And of course, what that means is radical feminism, as well as, you know, racial
politics. Leftist activism, so basically.
In that sense, there is very little support for what you're saying. There are maybe a few like prominent conservatives on campus, but you know, they are very far, like they are really rare and like far and few in between, I think. Mm-hmm. So there's a vocal political minority, and they are a minority. So they haven't like taken over everything, because you know that kind of politics is not really sustainable over the long term. And then the majority of the people don't really care. You know, of course, like, I mean, I just interact with like a lot of people on a friendly basis and like things like that. Mm-hmm. We don't usually discuss politics of this kind. So that's the environment on a college campus. And the majority of students actually really care nothing about Title IX or discrimination. They're just kind of like, you know, trying to get their degrees. But there is a vocal minority, and they are very active, and they are very hostile to whoever, you know, deviates from the party line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
well, yeah. I mean, what I was worrying about is off. You know, I don't know. I guess if you have like a network of people who support you that you can talk to and you know get help from in case you're like in trouble, and also. Mm-hmm. Like, I guess if you're, do you like talk with the guys at NCFM regularly enough and get any help from them?
I do talk to a lot of people. I've never received financial aid from NCFM.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the question, I'm going to be a speaker at the Chicago ICM.
That's right.
International
yeah.
Men's Issues Conference. But generally speaking, no, I haven't received any financial aid from NCFM.
Yeah, no, I didn't expect that, because those guys are struggling to keep ends meet as well, right? Everyone is like cafe and all that. It's all just whatever we can scrape up, and it's a challenge. So.
And part of the problem is, again, this financial discrimination. Colleges and the federal government in general distributes these massive grants and scholarships to these feminist advocacy organizations. They're really throwing money at them. The Department of Justice, for example, distributes this violence against women grants, which are usually hundreds of millions of dollars. And they do, like, the things that they do are so vague, like training programs. I mean, things like that. They don't really do anything substantial. It's not like medical research, or it's not something that even concretely helps women, if that's mm-hmm. the aim. So it's just like a real waste of money and resources, and all that money is, the federal government is distributing all that money to these feminist advocacy organizations who never lack any funding. But if you're engaging in advocacy for men, then, you know, you lose your reputation, you lose your livelihood, you get fired from your job, and there's also very little money to generate. So it's an extremely unfair fight, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, I'm doing my best, but I don't know how long I'll be able to sustain this advocacy. I've written more than a dozen complaints. Sometimes I also write complaints for other people who want to file them under their own names or who want to file them on behalf of their sons and things like that. So those people are also struggling. So I just like write all these like complaints pro bono. But then at some point you realize that this is impossible to sustain. Because mm-hmm. then nobody's paying you and you still have bills to pay. At some point, unfortunately, you have to stop, I guess, like with the advocacy. And there has been some positive effect. So I guess like that's a good thing. There's been one favorable resolution that recently against Tulane University. Tulane had one institute, which had an endowment of $30 million. Which was going to women only. And now after a resolution letter that changed, that money will now be available to both men and women. Some of the complaints that I wrote are challenging hundreds of millions of dollars of financial discrimination. So that's a huge amount. And maybe down the road, you know, things will improve. But right now, unfortunately, there's a bottleneck effect. And yeah. It's very hard. Like, I think we are going through like a hard time in general as men's rights activists.
Oh, absolutely. It is starting to change. There are changes starting to happen, but they're very slow. The stuff that you're doing is not going unnoticed. A couple of people have already donated. I've noticed, and thank you so much, guys, for doing that. But let's not stop the momentum. But also, with Cassie J's documentary and the ICMI has gotten a lot of attention. I know that we've had people from the mainstream media reach out to us about the ICMI with questions and stuff. And yes, we know that the media, you know, is likely going to try and.
I'm afraid of journalists. Like, yes. Interviews. And yeah. I regret some of those interviews now, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. No, we know they're going to try that. But you know what? At the end of the day, on some level, even after they trash you, they have to acknowledge some of the issues. And so it does sort of come out and it makes.
Yes, I think what happens is my own personal reputation gets ruined, but it is kind of like the message gets across. That was my personal experience. Yeah. By the way, my battery is about to die. I'm at 4 minutes.
Okay, so we're going to quit. That's okay.
Okay, I'm so sorry. It's my fault.
It's okay. I guess I was just closing it out to say that, you know, it's very difficult, and I understand that we are making some progress, though. I think that things are, yes. I wouldn't say they're changing, but I think that people are taking notice and they're not able to really ignore these issues. And yeah, it does mean that you end up getting like taking most of the brunt of all of the slander and stuff. But I just hope that, you know, you stay strong and you get the support you need and we'll stay in touch. So I want to thank you for coming on, Christoph. I'll close out with the audience. And yeah, that's it. You have any final words before you go?
No, thank you for everyone who has made donations. And then hopefully things will get better several years down the road. But right now, I think it's pretty tough. So.
All right. Well, yes. I want to thank you for coming on. And we'll talk to you later. Go charge your computer.
Yes. Thank you so much. Take care. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay. So that was Christoph Petgauz. He had to leave because, unfortunately, you know, he had he didn't have his computer plugged in and he wasn't near any way to charge it. So. But you know what? That's okay. The show went long enough. I hope you guys enjoyed and got a little bit of insight. I do want to tell you a little bit of additional info about this Professor Hillary Shore thing that he didn't really want to go into too much. But I can't help myself. Feminists are funny as fuck to me. She said, this is in her description of research, which I'm pretty sure she wrote herself because it's got that OMG so random vibe, and she's supposed to be like an English teacher. But let me tell you a little bit more about her. Okay, she writes books. Okay, she's the author of studies of the novelists Elizabeth Gaskell and Charles Dickens, which I already said, as well as essays on character trials. I don't know what that means, but it's in quotes. Victorian spectacle, voice over narration in novels and films, and Jane Eyre as a victim of sexual harassment. Jane Eyre as a victim of sexual harassment. I want to find out who Jane Eyre is real quick. And then I'll go into the after show and just like hang out with folks. Jane Eyre is a novel by writer Charlotte Bronte, published under the pen name Currer Bell, came out in 1847. It contains elements of social criticism, strong sense of Christian morality at its core, and is considered by many to be ahead of its time. Okay, well, anyway, I never read Jane Eyre. It sounds like some shit women would read or something. Jane Eyre. Okay, Jane Eyre. Sorry, I didn't mean to mispronounce that. I mean, I don't care that much, but her most recent book, Curious Subjects, Women and the Trials of Realism, moves from 17th century poetry to 18th century epistolary fiction, 19th century fairy tales and optical devices, and 20th century time travel films. She is currently at work working on a project on Jews, women, and other Victorian legal fictions, which reimagines the romance of politics and the power of forgiveness. What does that have to do with Jews? She has served as a chair of gender studies. So she's been the chair of gender studies, president of the Academic Senate. And in 2006 to 2007, she served as dean of undergraduate programs for the College of Letters, Arts, and Sciences. She is currently a co-director of the Center for Law, History, and Culture, a joint center sponsored by USC Dornsife College and the Gould School of Law. So, only reason why I wanted to read all of that was because she's supposed to be, according to Christoph, she's not a good professor. And I wouldn't be surprised if he was absolutely right about that. But I just get the sense that it doesn't matter if you're a bad director as long as you have the right ideas. You can become the chair of gender studies. A job, by the way, that I imagine isn't that hard to do. Okay. Yeah, it's bad. It's bad. Jane Eyre is actually quite good. Well, it seems like she's criticizing it. So, hold on a second. Someone just sent me a message. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to wrap up. I'm going to go into the after show and basically just continue the conversation that we already started. And so to do that, you just got to become a badger by going to feedthebadger.com and starting a monthly subscription. That'll get you into our Discord and you can hang out with us in the after show there. So please consider doing that. We're just going to chit-chat about whatever the patrons want. Maybe we'll look at more of these feminist professors at USC, the University of Southern California, where Christoph is at. And we'll use that to get a laugh. So if you want to be a part of that, again, go to feedthebadger.com, start a monthly subscription. And it'll get you into the Discord, get you into the after shows. You'll be able to watch them. If you pay enough, you'll be able to be a part of them. For this one, it's actually quite low level. That'll get you right in, and you'll be able to join us in the Dire Hawk's Den, which is a chat that everyone who has access to Discord can access. So please consider doing that. With that said, I'm going to go ahead and get out of here. I want to thank you guys for coming on. I want to thank Christoph for joining us on This Week in Men's Rights. To learn a little bit more about his situation, please, please, please consider going and contributing to his GoFundMe. $1 doesn't matter, man. Just whatever you can do, whatever you can do. And he's very grateful. I have a feeling, honestly, if he doesn't. So, just in case you guys don't know, he was supposed to get a $35,000 a year stipend to go to college. And the college took the money from him because of his politics. So he is basically without money now. And of course, I assume that he's probably working some kind of job, or he's got stuff saved up, or some combination. But the guy shouldn't be struggling, just because he has the wrong ideas. So please consider helping by going to his GoFundMe. And that'd be great. So thanks again for coming on this episode of The Week in Men's Right. Please give us a like, subscribe, hit the bell for notifications, and leave a comment. And I'll talk to you guys in the next one.